Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
This is the Fix Your Sciatica Podcast.
Bone density. We need to have strong bones in order for us to function, minimize pain, but just overall feel good. And this is a metric that actually declines as we age, and especially during the perimenopause and menopausal points of life. So today, I have Dr. Susan Baumgartel, who actually works with many folks going through the perimenopause and menopausal states. And she was really kind enough to take some time out of her day to talk about bone density, some of the sciences behind it. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about the tips and tricks to help maximize this specific metric, and talk about the importance and why it is key to ensure that we have good, solid bone density. So, Susan, it's so great to see you again. Thank you so much for being on today's episode.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to come back, and what a great day to talk about a good topic.
It's a fantastic topic. I don't think it's a topic that gets covered enough, unfortunately, and I know that a lot of patients get sent to me to improve their bone density. And so I think one of the challenges is that there was another physician, I think about 6 to 8 months ago, who was talking about they knew a lot of benefits about physical therapy, but physical therapy was kind of like a black box in regards to, like, I know it works, but I don't really know what's going on. And the same thing, like, I know that you physicians know a lot, but I don't know what's going on as well. And I have a general understanding of the science behind bone density and the key things. So I thought it'd be a great opportunity for us to join forces and really attack this subject together. So let's reintroduce you to the audience. For the folks who haven't had the opportunity to meet you yet, tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So I'm a physician in internal medicine. Got my MD about 31 years ago. Ouch. Practiced for 25 years full-time primary care internal medicine in hospital and mostly outpatient after that. And so really saw the full gamut of adult medicine, and certainly a lot of the bulk of my practice were women and women in their kind of midlife. I think maybe a third of my practice were also seniors. So I think my oldest was 106, so all the way up there. And then 3 years ago, I pivoted, that great pivot during the pandemic, and started my own business. It's called My MD Advocate. And what I do is really online telemedicine medical consultation and advocacy work. So I'm no longer doing, touching someone doing clinical medicine, but I'm really drawing upon my expertise and experience and really helping people navigate a lot of tough times in their lives, especially if it's hard to find a doctor or, find the right approach to a certain medical condition. So it's been really gratifying. During this time, I also started a website a few years back called Menopause Menu. It's a free site. It really is kind of an informational website for women and actually for everyone. And it has a lot of different pages. I think there's 16 different pages, subpages, but it's also a blog. So it's really fun to have blog articles and videos and recipes. And of course, after that, I wrote a book called The Menopause Menu. And so that kind of all came together. But great to be here and to kind of dovetail with your knowledge in terms of physical therapy approach to patients with osteoporosis.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. Yeah, I remember when that book came out and I had the opportunity to take a look, and it's fantastic. So listeners, if you are going through that point in life where you're going through perimenopause or menopause, it's a great resource. And I love the fact that it's the Menopause Menu, because you actually have some really delicious and amazing tidbits in there, which I found to be really, really cool. So I'm so thrilled. So let's talk about, the process of aging and specifically bone density. I think that there, and I know for me as a physical therapist and just looking at the aging population, it's like, okay, when you hit a certain age, you should start getting some scans and establishing a baseline. I know that they use the DEXA scan as the main way to actually help assess bone density. I actually had a DEXA scan for myself a couple weeks ago. Nothing's wrong with me. It was really more I have been focusing on just ensuring that I age gracefully. I'm 36 years old right now, but I wanted to get a good solid baseline. And what's really cool is that there's a company, this is not a paid advertisement, by the way, but there's a company called BodySpec, which is a startup kind of, I think based out of San Francisco, and they have multiple locations in the Bay Area. But you go and you get a DEXA scan, you get a whole bunch of other measurements as well. So so let's talk about bone density. What are you looking at in regards to, like, what is bone density? What are the changes that happen as we get older? And I answered my question already, but like, what are some ways that we can measure bone density as well?
Yeah. So first of all, the bigger kind of the 20,000 foot view is like, why do we even care about bone density? Well, we care about it because we're trying to prevent fracture. I mean, that's really the bottom line. And so we're talking about fracture risk reduction. And if we look at your skeletal health and your bone quality and your bone density, we can get information about, you know, your system that can tell us, are you at risk for fracture? And so that's kind of the nugget. So when you think about what are we looking at when we're thinking about bone density, we're trying to screen for something called osteopenia or osteoporosis. Osteopenia is kind of mild diminished bone mineral density, and osteoporosis is significant diminished bone mineral density. So kind of, it's like a gradient. So normal kind of osteopenia is like you're on your way, and osteoporosis is like, whoa, that's not good. And so we're talking about decreased bone mineral density. The DEXA, or the bone density dexatometry scan, will measure the bone density. That's important because we can kind of, again, put people into kind of risk reduction groups. You know, are they at high risk? Are they at moderate risk? Are they at low risk? If they haven't had a fracture yet, of course. But there's a very interesting concept. And if you interviewed me about maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I would have said, like, gosh, you know, there's no way to measure bone quality. Well, there is now, and it's called a trabecular kind of score. And so basically you can get a bone density test with a trabecular score, and that tells you something about the bone quality. And what I mean by that is, like, sounds morbid, but if you're dead and we cut your bone up and we look under a microscope, we can look at the structure of the bone itself, and we can get information about the quality of the structure of the bone. That is different than bone density. So we all know, well, maybe we don't all know, but we all suspected that there was something else beyond just bone density in terms of people's risk for fracture. And so that was really kind of an important part of the equation. So now we have this tool. It's something you don't have to get all the time, but like a one time measurement would be great, especially as someone's aging. So that's kind of the bigger components of what we're looking at when we're talking about bone density.
And that makes perfect sense. I mean, I think especially in this day and age, as we have all the amazing technology, we're starting to really transition into a world of looking at quality over quantity, right? And I really appreciate that you bringing that up, which brings up to another question, and I didn't even think about it, but you were talking about risk of fractures, right? So we have obviously our DEXA scan, we also have the trabecular score. Are there any other risk factors in regards to that, just so that we can take into account?
Yeah. And so I think it's an important distinction to make between like a fracture, like you fall down, you know, a mine shaft and you fracture your pelvis, or you fall off a horse, you fracture, you know, some major accident, versus what we're calling fragility fractures. And so fragility fractures are fractures that don't really necessarily happen in the context of a major trauma. Maybe you bump into a door frame, like, well, that shouldn't really hurt. You know, I mean, that might hurt, you might bruise, but that shouldn't fracture. And so it's the fragility fractures that we're concerned about, not like if you're in a car accident. I mean, that's horrible, but, you know, that's a different kind of fracture, of course. Or you're in a skating rink and you take a spin, you know, you fracture. So fragility fractures where you're not anticipating a bone should have fractured, that's kind of the concern. So there are lots of things in terms of, we can get a little later on, we can talk about prevention. But yeah, I mean, there are things that can trash your skeletal system, like smoking or heavy alcohol use. You know, those are things obviously that are imperative to kind of get a handle on. There are medications, there are medical conditions. I can go more into that later. But it's important to know that it's, you're not a sitting duck for fracture just because you're aging. We can talk about menopause in terms of that role too. But there are things that kind of set people up for a fragility fracture that we need to know about.
This episode is brought to you by the Patient Advocate Program. Are you tired of not having support between your rehab sessions? Introducing the Patient Advocate Program, and we're focused on your recovery, and we're offering you 24/7 access to a doctorate of physical therapy. Stop waiting in line to be seen and stop spending hours doing long exercise programs. Imagine being able to get all of your care delivered straight to your phone. Best of all, it's affordable. We believe everyone deserves top-notch relief without breaking the bank. So why wait? Take control of your health today and visit PTPatientAdvocate.com and book your free call with our experts. Yeah, you bring up a really good point. So let's talk about like the perimenopausal state and the menopausal state and its special role, right? Because we know that there's going to be a difference compared to men who don't go through menopause and then women who go through the perimenopausal states and those change in hormones. Us men, our biologies are pretty simple. So like things will just slowly decline. But I know that things are certainly quite different in those other states. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and so it's important maybe to take a step back and kind of throw out a few definitions. So, pre-menopause are the years before menopause is going to happen. So if you're 20 years old, you're pre-menopause. If you're 29, you're pre-menopause. If you're 41, you're probably still pre-menopause. Peri means around, like perimeter. Perimenopause are the years around the menopausal phase, and it's different for every woman, but you can generally think of that as probably the 40s into the 50s. And then menopause is 12 months without a period. So, you know, definition of menopause, assuming you still have a uterus. And then postmenopause is all that time frame after. And that's an interesting point, because I've taken care of so many women who are 70, like, oh, that was so many years ago. It's like, nope, you're postmenopause till you die. You know, if you're 98 years old, you're still postmenopause. And so obviously what I'm not throwing into this kind of mix of definitions is surgical menopause, which could happen at any age, of course. That's removal of both ovaries. Or other menopause, like due to radiation or chemo or other drugs. So again, so when you think about what's happening during menopause is, you know, it's all about hormones. So that estrogen, other hormones like progesterone, but the estrogen, it's all about estrogen, is declining. And so diminished estrogen is the primary process in when we think about the impact on bone density. Interestingly, it's also inherently involved in a term you probably know about, which is sarcopenia, which is diminished muscle mass. And so there's a lot going on, you know, in a woman's midlife. God knows there's so much going on, but that's what's happening in terms of the effects of estrogen. And estrogen, you know, if we think about the building blocks, you know, there are different types of cells, and the osteoblasts are these cells that actually build bone, and the osteoclasts reabsorb bone, and so they're kind of taking it down. And the estrogen directly inhibits osteoclast activity, which is fascinating for a scientist. And there's a lot of good research now looking at this in terms of should estrogen be offered to women solely on the basis of helping their bone density. And there's lots of benefit for that. So this reduced bone density kind of process, which is a natural process, the most active time period is the first 5 years into postmenopause. So let's say we take an average age, 47 to 52, we'll just say, you know, 50 for the sake of this discussion. So from 50 to 55, that would be that magical time period where you're going to see the most accelerated diminishment of bone mineral density due to the fact that estrogen's not there in high amounts anymore, and it's not inhibiting that osteoclast activity, so bone is reabsorbed. So that's a really important kind of equation to keep in mind.
Yeah. So in life and in bone development, we're looking at the combination of both osteoblasts, the bone builders, and the osteoclastic, which is the the breakdown in estrogen will actually inhibit that osteoclast activity as well. So I really appreciate you sharing that, because it gives us an opportunity to really see behind or underneath the microscope, right? To be able to see what is happening. And so we know that's happening. And as you said, it's like a very big pivotal moment in a woman's life. I actually had the opportunity, I think it was about a year ago, I had you on an episode. We talked about menopause even more in depth. So listeners, I'm going to go ahead and put the link to that show in the notes. But then also I was interviewing another person in the menopausal space, and they were talking about, yeah, it's a very big pivotal moment. There's a lot of big changes, because at that time, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm missing anything, at that time, it's like at like the 40 and 50 year age range, it's like you're having to manage parents who are getting older. And then you're also transitioning the kids out of the house, right? So it's like a lot of changes and a lot of stressors that happen in addition to these chemical changes that happen within the body. Does that sound about right?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I could wax poetic for, I don't know, 3 hours? I mean, there's impact on sleep patterns. There's maybe someone is changing jobs. Maybe that got fired. Maybe they quit. Maybe they're retiring early. You know, maybe their parent is ill or sick of that sandwich generation. It's just, there's so much that's packed into there right at this time in a woman's life when she's really navigating these hormonal shifts. So it's, I just kind of sit in wonderment sometimes when I think about, like, wow, when I was a kid, or probably, you know, what powers that be have the child going through puberty and the mother going through menopause? That's like hell on wheels. So I don't know. My mother's long since gone, but I'm amazed that she went through all this without talking about it, because you know what? Now we're able to talk about it in a much better way. And so we're finally coming into our own in that regard.
Yeah. I've seen it throughout my career, is that, especially at that age, yeah, there's a lot of changes, and I'm just so amazed, because, one, I'm still not in that phase in my life yet to be able to see those changes, but I can't even imagine or fathom. So I have a whole appreciation for that. So, before we go into talking about, like, okay, the idea is that as women approach that age, the estrogen is there to stop the osteoclast activity to make the bones become a little bit more fragile, right? So let's talk about prevention and management in the various different stages, right? Because I know that I'm getting some women who are in post-menopause, and they are osteoporotic, but they're being sent to me because they need to improve their bone density. But I think throughout this entire conversation, a lot of people think, oh, osteoporosis, this is a death sentence. I can't turn this around, right? So before we go into the management aspect of it, let's talk about the prevention, some of the preventive measures and things that we, the listeners could do to get them prepared for this phase in life, especially when it comes to bone health.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this ahead of time, and I guess the top two, I think, we'll peel off and do a bit more deeper dive on. So nutrition and exercise. So let's kind of skip over that just for the moment. I do think they're the most important, but we'll come back to that. So nutritional stuff, exercise, movement. You know, I can't preach this enough. Stop smoking. In this day and age, you think there's like a million reasons not to smoke. Here's yet another one. It's trash in your bones. Minimize alcohol. Doesn't mean that alcohol is like, if you have a glass of wine or a cocktail, you're trashing your bones. But heavy alcohol use, especially consistent use or daily use, is going to impact a lot of things that are important for bone mineral metabolism. So it's not good. Medications. So there are medications that some people actually have to be on for medical problems. You know, maybe they have asthma, they're on steroids, or they have rheumatoid arthritis or other conditions where they have to be on a prednisone or steroids. Proton pump inhibitors. Oh my gosh, half the planet seems to be on these acid blockers. So they have stomach, you know, GERD or acid reflux. So Prilosec, Prevacid, Nexium, there's so many out there now. Aromatase inhibitors, if they've had breast cancer, perhaps like anastrozole. You know, there are other medications, and all of these are detrimental to bone mineral density. So again, some of these you have to be on. If you have breast cancer and you're on anastrozole, then you're not going to stop it. But then you have to be on on red alert, so to speak, in terms of monitoring. Not everyone can get off their proton pump inhibitor, but boy, if you can, it's worth it to think about other ways to treat perhaps acid reflux. So again, medications can directly impact bone density. Underlying conditions, whether you have them or you don't know that you have them. So people should be screened for basic things like thyroid disorder or parathyroid disorder, because parathyroid is very involved in that kind of equation that, you know, think about phosphorus and calcium and toss in vitamin D there, you know, so all those things that are important for bone integrity. We think about hereditary or familial things. So there are some people who have family histories of people who have had fractured or actually know that they have osteoporosis. And I'll tell you the story, because to this day, I'm just blown away by it. Many, many, many years ago, long before we knew anything about bone quality, and the bone density tests were kind of still, you know, were around, but the DEXA scans were around, but hadn't really been perfected. I had a fellow who was, I'm trying to think, he was in his mid-40s, and he's helping a buddy of his move a refrigerator, and he fractured his spine. He did okay, but, you know, it's terrible. And I think, I'm like, God, this guy was like weightlifter. I mean, he was healthy. He was super healthy. Why would he have a fracture? It wasn't like he lift the fridge up. He was just like wiggling it into position. And so, you know, all these tests and all these, you know, I couldn't figure it out. I mean, he didn't have any underlying illness. There was nothing going on. It was very just perplexing. And then, and I thought I knew him, he said, oh, well, my mother, my two sisters, and my aunt all had osteoporosis. Like, whoa, wait a minute, time out. And so I did this more of a family history. Well, it turns out he grew up in the tropics and he never had milk. So his entire formative years as a little boy and into adulthood, he never had milk, and he was kind of a short guy, so who knows, but oh my goodness. So yeah, it turned out the entire family could have been, you know, the poster family for Fosamax, but truly it was a revelation. So again, you know, family history, even though you may not know it, can certainly play a role. Like I said before, another risk factor, if you want to put that way, is just being postmenopause. I mean, you just have to think about, you know, is someone going to be at higher risk? Especially if they're not on hormones. And then, you know, there are medications when we think about treatment. We can get into that down the road in terms of what you might think of to manage your osteoporosis in addition to nutrition and exercise. And I don't know if you want to just, maybe I can take you for a quick tour of meds right now. So many people have talked about bisphosphonates. They've heard of that before, like alendronate, which is Fosamax, or resendronate, which is Actonel, or Boniva, which is the monthly. These are the drugs that first came out. I'm trying to think about, I think it was probably 30, maybe 35 years-ish ago. They've gone through many iterations over time in terms of how you take them and the safety of them, but they're the kind of the tried and true treatments. And then there's the IV version of one of the bisphosphonates reclassed. A lot of people have heard of that. You know, they go in and get their infusion. It's really quick. And then there's the anabolic agents, the ones that are kind of helping to rebuild bone. Thinking about like Forteo, that was the first one. I think it came out. It's a shot. It's a teriparatide. It's like it mimics human parathyroid hormone. There's the more recent one, I think, was Timlose. I think the most recent was Evenity. I think Evenity is more like a monoclonal antibody. So again, then there's like a Prolia. Everyone's heard of Prolia. That's a monoclonal antibody. And then there's the selective estrogen receptor modifiers. There's raloxifene or Avista. So there's a huge list of medicines that if you see a specialist like a rheumatologist or an orthopedic specialist, sports medicine, or a good primary care doc, you're going to kind of go through that in terms of what drug works best for you. And there's a lot of protocols in terms of how you select which drug for which person, which I won't go into, but just know that there are many different options to treat. And this is there's a kind of two arms of treatment. There's reduction in further loss of bone density, and there's stabilization and hopefully, fingers crossed, improvement. And so those are kind of parallel goals that most people follow.
So I really appreciate you sharing that, because I think one of the many challenges in just general healthcare is that, and I think that you physicians are just extremely brilliant human beings. And so after having conversations with you, obviously in this episode, but I think what's amazing is the fact that you as a physician, clinician, can get these clues and then in your head can reach these patterns, pattern recognition in such a fast period of time. And I think a big challenge in medicine is the fact that if you're seeing your doctor maybe for 5-10 minutes, you're probably thinking, how the heck do they come up with this conclusion in such a fast period of time, right? And oftentimes people are like, yeah, I guess my doctor was kind of just like guessing. And I assure you, listeners, that when you're working with your doctor, they've gone through so many years of training, but they've seen so many patients that they've had the opportunity to be able to collect the most important information to help them determine the best option for you. And I have said this on multiple other podcasts, but when it comes to, say, treating the human, and especially when it comes to science, we start off with our hypothesis, and it's a process of elimination to be able to say, okay, well, this is the scenario. What are our best treatment options? And then based off of the information, what can we do? But it's not going to be just implementing the treatment and then just like disappearing. It's implementing the treatment and actually evaluating, is it actually helping? And so I again, thank you so much, Susan, for really sharing that process, because in those short interactions that we have with our physicians, it's really, really hard to see what goes on in the back end. And it can come off as cold, short, and really just a subpar experience. And granted that, you know, this is an entirely different conversation talking about just the general medical system, but really I wanted to just highlight the brilliance and the knowledge that you guys have when it comes to managing your patients. So,
thank you. And I'll call you out and say thank you for that, because I think that what's really grounding for me and for most physicians that I consider really high quality is we start from an evidence-based perspective, and that could include 10 or 20 or 30 years of experience and training. So it's not just, you know, looking something up on Google, God forbid. And for me, then it's using that evidence-based experience approach and weaving in kind of the holistic measures that make it valuable and speak to someone in their language in terms of what they feel is important for them. So it's the marrying of those two together, which is it's the secret sauce.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. So talking about from the changes, risk mitigation, as you're describing this, one of the things that I didn't hear much about, which I'm actually very excited to hear, is the role in calcium, right? It's not just, oh, get more calcium. It's understanding that there's like many different factors at play, and we'll be able to get a little bit more of an idea as we talk about the nutrition recommendations on some of that. So let's talk about, we'll break nutrition down into two parts. Let's talk about the prevention measures, or like the things that kind of get you prepared for the transition. And then when you're in the postmenopausal state and in the osteopenic, osteoporotic state, how can we manage that?
Yeah, well, I think ahead of time, if you have normal bone mineral density, there's no big laundry list of things you should do. I think it's just really good, healthy eating, as everyone would kind of try to think about good ways to get vegetables, good ways to eat the rainbow, good ways to get protein, and good ways to stay hydrated. Calcium is kind of a really integral part before, during, and after. And I think it's worth talking about, because so many people, we're in this culture like we want a pill for that. And, you know, and I've spent, I don't know, the last 30 years trying to convince people to get nutritional components from their nutrition, from the foods they eat, instead of a whole handful of pills. And I'm so honestly fed up with the industries out there, and including in my field too. You know, people just want to sell you their latest pill bottle and it has their name on it, you know, and I'm tired of that industry pushing it down people's throats. Just take this pill that has 47 different things in it. Do we really need molybdenum? I don't know. So calcium is important to get, but it's also important not to overdo it. And so if you have someone who is willing to look at the food content, you know, the nutritional breakdown of what they're eating, and try to get enough nutrients, they don't have to go out of their way to get a whole bunch of extra pills. And keep in mind, when you have calcium in a pill, in a supplement, and you're getting more than perhaps your body can take in at that moment, you're just peeing it out. So we're feeding the fish. So, you know, you may be taking handfuls of these calcium pills like, oh boy, I'm doing such a good job, but you're not benefiting from it. And on the flip side, you could actually be harmful because too much calcium in some ways is actually detrimental. Don't even get me started on, you know, the insult to the kidneys. So I would say a look at food groups. Obviously, a lot of people shy away from dairy for a bunch of reasons, but anything dairy, of course. And then if you look at some of those non-dairy substitutes like oat milk or whatever milk, you know, they often do have calcium fortification. But, you know, there's wonderful things out there that have calcium that you wouldn't necessarily think about as a daily food, although I certainly do, like tofu or tempeh, you know, certain nuts. You can get calcium in lots of those green leafy veggies, spinach, kale, broccoli, bok choy. I mean, there's lots out there, probably chard, that is not just a dairy thing. So if you kind of put all that together, you can get a fair amount of calcium. I would say now we're going into the postmenopause or actually having maybe borderline osteoporosis like osteopenia or actual osteoporosis, you probably do need a supplement in addition to good nutrition. And there are many different types of calcium, calcium citrate, calcium carbonate, the list goes on. I'd say calcium citrate is probably the best absorbed in terms of the usefulness. Calcium carbonate is in Tums. So some people like pop Tums, but you know, you may not need Tums. And if you kind of just as a generic rule, try to get about 1200 milligrams a day, but not all at once. So you want to break that up into half. So half of that is 600. So you think about 600 twice a day. You really can't absorb much more than maybe around 600 anyway. So if you take all that all at once, you're feeding the fish. So it's important to think about that. On a side note, there are many people who get constipated with calcium. So that's why you see all these products that calcium mag, you know, magnesium is going to maybe do the opposite. So that's why they're, you know, it's often calcium, magnesium, zinc, you know, that's like a common supplement. So it's not that those are bad, but again, you don't need everything else unless you're having trouble with too much calcium.
Makes total sense. And I really am thankful that you're able to clarify that because it's like, yeah. Oh, awesome. You should drink more milk. But going through this, it brought up two really interesting questions that I would love to present to you. So, and this is just based off of my like very loose understanding on even just the role of like soy and estrogenic type foods. And so earlier on this episode, you said that estrogen prevents or inhibits osteoclast activity. So when you're reaching a stage, or so if you look at foods like soy is often thought to be estrogenic or like stimulates that, or I don't know that much about the science, but I know that the role of soy and estrogen does have some sort of play together. Tell us a little bit more about like the use of soy. Is it something that like, okay, maybe should, it's like, obviously it's a great source of protein, but also, like, is this like knowing that its role in estrogen, like, is this something that like when women are in the postmenopausal stage that they could migrate towards that? Tell us a little bit more about soy.
I think, and I'm not an expert on soy, but I would say that, you know, when you think about phytoestrogens or kind of an estrogen component in nature, like a soy product, soybean, that mimics estrogen's activity in the body, that can be helpful. There's tons of research and data kind of looking at, you know, is this, you know, if you take a whole bunch of soy, will, you know, help your hot flashes, will you reduce your night sweats, will help with all those kind of estrogen loss symptoms. And, you know, I wouldn't say the jury's out because there's tons of great information. I would say it's individualized. So some people will benefit from that and others, it didn't work for me. I am always, and this is maybe just my personal style, I'm always less proscriptive, like do this, don't do that. I don't like that. I'd rather say like, is this person in front of me, is this person interested in learning more about, you know, eating different things that could help with their nutrition? Oh, are they curious about things like tofu or soy? And then I can kind of explore how it would work for them. Because as my approach, and I've actually run a weight management program for many years in the past. You know, getting away from the word diet, which I think is a four-letter word, and not telling someone, you know, eat this or don't eat that. More just like, you know, let's incorporate that into their routine, or maybe they can toss, you know, bits of tofu or something into their stir fry, or instead of like specifically, oh, I should eat this because that's going to be good for me. So I don't know if that is answering your question, but
yeah, no, it absolutely does. And I appreciate that because, oh, well, one that just thought just came up to me as you were talking about the estrogen effects on like osteoclastic activity. I was like, oh, this could be an opportunity. And plus I know that, so I'm Chinese. I know that a lot of the Asian cultures eat a fair amount of soy. And so it was just an interesting thing to look into.
Well, and my husband's Japanese American. And in my book, I have several recipes, and I think he fainted dead away when he realized I was taking pictures of them that he made that have some really, really good healthy aspects when you think about soy and tofu. So check it out.
Absolutely. I'm going to put the link to the book into the show notes as well. So listeners, you can take a look. And another question, you're talking about like weight management, but especially I see a lot in the nutrition realm, and they talk about how a lot of like, even just like Americans in general, aren't getting enough protein. And as I was looking at it, it was like, okay, you might not be eating enough protein, but watch out for eating too much because it can then actually leach away some of your bone density. Can you share with us a little bit more insight into protein's role in regards to some like general recommendations from like a gram per body weight? And then also, share with us a little bit more. Like I've heard people, it's like, if you eat too much protein, it kind of like takes away a little bit of that bone density as well. Or is that just a long held belief?
I actually don't think too much protein. I mean, probably there are very few people who get too much protein. I'd say it's usually the opposite. People aren't getting enough protein. Or they say like, oh, I have a good, you know, I have a meat with dinner. Well, that's probably not enough to carry you out, you know, throughout the day. And so, you know, the equation, the recommendation 1 gram per weight of body weight is probably good to shoot for. But, there are medical conditions where you don't want too much protein. And I'm thinking of kidney failure. That's the top one there, or other conditions that are causing great effects in the body. But I think really most people need to get more protein, bottom line, and get away from this thought of like meat as the only thing that gives you protein. A lot of people ask me about protein supplements like powders and drinks. And I pause for a moment because I don't want to sound like a Debbie Downer, but I just, again, this is just my philosophy. It's not right or wrong. I just don't like when you have to reach for something you have to mix and swirl and swig as that's nutritional value. You know, yes, there are situations where you do need that. Maybe someone's really powerlifting and actually aggressively bulking up and at a gym where they're really trying to be physically at the top of their prime. Yeah, they're probably going to have to supplement with protein powder, but very few people should. And as you age, definitely thinking about someone who's 60, 70s and 80s, you shouldn't be doing that. It's not healthy. Get your protein for nutritional sources and you're going to just feel and function so much better.
And it's also so much more fun to chew on a piece of meat than it is to crush a smoothie, which is, I mean, that's my personal opinion. I love eating more so than drinking my calories. And so, but yeah, absolutely. Like there's a lot of like non-meat protein options. I'm just going to throw this out there. Last week, my wife and I made spaghetti and red sauce. It's one of my favorite dishes. I usually throw a can of tuna in there as well because it's a New Jersey Italian thing, which is fantastic, which is where I'm from. But we switched it out. Instead of a can of tuna, we actually switched it out with a can of chickpeas. And it was fantastic. And little did I know that chickpeas is a large part of Southern Italian cooking, especially if you're looking on the Eastern side near Puglia. And that's where we had a ton of chickpeas. And so that was very, very cool. And let's talk about, and in regards to protein, right? Protein is one of the big important parts of building muscle. And as you were talking about this, it was like, okay, risk, fracture risk. And one of the things that came to my mind as I wrote this down, you're sharing this with me, was the fact that when you have more muscle, you technically have a little bit more cushion between you and anything. And I mean, obviously fat is a cushion as well, but I felt not felt, but I noticed that muscle is a much better shock absorber because it can distribute force and it can also generate movement. It's much more functional than fat as well, which then kind of brings us into the exercise portion of today's talk, where we're, because obviously exercise loading the bone actually allows us to improve the strength. So tell us a little bit more about some, like, the importance of exercise and some good solid ways to implement that.
Yeah, well, this is definitely your field. I would say that almost everyone has heard about weight bearing activities. And so when it comes to working on your bone density health, both prevention and treatment, you want to think about things that are weight bearing. And so it doesn't mean you have to have weights on your hands or in your body, just gravity. You know, if we're out for a walk, that is technically a weight bearing activity. Yes, you can have very small hand weights. And I think here's a moment to pause, because when people think about weights, they often think like, you know, really, you know, working really hard. But you can have 3 to 5 pound hand weights, you know, pretty reasonable, and do a lot. So it's not the weights, it's the reps. And so if you can just kind of repeat that movement, you can actually get kind of sculpt your body in a way that you're going to be pretty happy with, but you're not weight lifting. So it doesn't have to be heavy, but it's repetition. And then, you know, honestly, this is something where I have to kind of swallow my pride here. I've been very purposeful about exercise over many years, but more so since I was diagnosed and treated for cancer at the beginning of this year, because I kind of made it my mantra. And previous to that, I would say, you know, 2 to 3 times a week, you know, because we all don't have time because we're all so darn busy. Daily is really the key, because that does so many things. Because when you do something on a daily basis for your body, you are allowing much more growth and stability in your muscles and your joints, of course, but your bone, we're talking about bone health today, than if you did it just once or twice a week. So I just want to put a plug for people to think about doing something on a daily basis. Building muscle, like you mentioned, is helpful because it stabilizes joints and reduces falls. We think about your core strength. We think about balance. And so strength training to help reduce falls is essential for people, I think. Again, walking's great, but you're exercising your quads, maybe your hamstrings, you know, your hip flexors maybe, but you're not really doing a lot of the other intrinsic muscle groups, and you're not focusing your efforts on kind of stability. I have a lot of patients who've gone for walks and they trip over a tree root, or they trip over a crack on the sidewalk, and oh my God, you know. So again, walks can be dangerous. So those types of things, just in terms of general concepts, are really key for people to realize. Weight bearing, do it daily, thinking about building muscle, working on your balance, working on your core, working on your stability in terms of fall precautions and fall risk reduction.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in 100% agreement with that. Exercise itself. And I think what's really interesting is that from my experience, like looking into the exercise industry, the US, like, we've actually like really popularized like the concept of like specific exercise sessions. Like, you go in, out into Europe, like, you can rarely find a gym to work out at. And what was really interesting is that if we look at the Europeans, like, they're up and they're moving all the time. And one of the great things is the fact that we're actually, you're going against gravity and you're actually loading up your muscles. And so your muscles and your bones, right? And so I also really appreciate you talking about the concept of like adding small weights. And really the idea of lifting weights or weightlifting is actually manipulating an external force. So whether it be a 1 pound weight or a 50 pound weight, it's going to be more than what you're just doing in regards to moving your limbs. So even just that. And when it comes to building up bone density, I know that, and correct me if I'm not up to date with this, but oftentimes when it comes to, say, like looking at the DEXA scan and bone density, we're looking at the lumbar spine, like the vertebral bodies. We're also looking at the humerus bone, which is your arm bone. And we're also looking at the femur, which is going to be our thighs. And so when I come across patients who are looking to improve their bone density, there are a couple different things that I would usually implement. Obviously, walking is going to be a great one. if their balance is sufficient, right? That's going to be the most important part. If you do need to walk with a cane or a walker because you don't feel the most balanced, like, that's totally fine. I'd much rather have you walk a little bit slower without actually you risking any sort of trip and fall. But when it comes to even just general, like, bone health, and this is something that I prescribe for my 16-year-old, my 30-year-old, and then my 80-year-old, is the concept of we have to be able to squat. And squatting, interestingly enough, is just getting in and out of your chair. So you can do it without arms. You could do it with your arms. There's been a lot of information about, like, oh, like, squatting is bad for your knees, or like, you need to do X, Y, and Z. I like to think, as long as you're moving at the level of your hip, you're going to be able to be really healthy. You're going to generate a lot more muscle. You're going to feel a lot better. And that's also going to be protective of your back, which is a lot of the patients that I work with. When it comes, and the cool thing is, like, when you're doing something like squats, you're going to be stressing and putting pressure through your femurs, because you're vertically loading. And then when it comes to your humerus bone, aka your arm bone, we have something. I think one of my favorite exercises to improve bone density is a press. So anything like a push-up, I like to do countertop push-ups for folks who don't have the strength or mobility to get down to the floor. And then just really focusing on proper positioning. It's like humerus and also the radius bone that we also look at too. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Bounder.
A true DEXA looks at the lumbar spine and the femur. So it doesn't involve the ankle or the wrist at all.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. And what I found, interestingly enough, is that bone does a very good, like, bone responds really well to impact and stress along the longitudinal axis, right? It's good from a compression standpoint. They don't really like bending much, which is one of the reasons why it's a little bit harder for, and maybe it takes a little bit longer for, like, broken feet bones to heal, because of the fact that, like, when you're walking, you're kind of stressing out, kind of bending at the bow. So that's just something to consider. And then in regards to, like, improving, like, spinal health, the key is movement, but ensuring that we're not moving too much at the spine. Our spine is actually designed to kind of absorb and carry load, but really it's supposed to distribute the forces to your hips and to your shoulders. So if you're moving too much at the spine, not stabilizing your core, that's where things can start to be problematic. But in some cases, I know for myself, I like to add a little bit of weight to, like, say, a backpack or to a vest when I go for a walk. It kind of does a double whammy where it does both my spine and my hips as well. So those are some really great activities that you can fit into your day. Granted that as long as you're under the care or supervision of your doctor, your physical therapist, like, you don't have to go through these things yourself. You can obviously experiment with all this by yourself, but if you want to really get into the nitty gritty and make sure that you're doing things right, because as we said before, it's not just the quantity, like how much or what you do, it's how you do it. And if you're, as long as you're able to do it correctly, it really minimizes the risk of injury and helps you feel a lot better. So nutrition, exercise, looking into the common aspects of medical conditions and medications, are there any other key action steps that the listeners can take in regards to their bone health? So, like, things that they should be asking their doctor, or any sort of specific tests, or at what age? Tell us a little bit more about what people could do.
Yeah, there are a number of things I think that should be at the top of the list. So for women, if you're post-menopause, I would get a baseline DEXA. Now, keep in mind that insurance bugaboo, you know, so they may not cover it necessarily. Lord knows why Medicare decided that 65 was when you get a baseline. That's bogus, in my opinion. But a good doctor can probably find the correct code to use to get it legitimately covered. Hint, hint. So if you're going through menopause and you're post-menopause, mid-period for a year, I think a baseline DEXA is a good idea. Now, you may have already had that sooner in life if you have risk factors. So for everyone, not just women, for everyone, if you do have risk factors for osteoporosis, get a baseline screening. I think that's really important to know early before, you know, prevention's key, right? Before you have, you know, considerable bone mineral density decline. If you have unexplained fractures, like you didn't have, you didn't fall off your horse, you didn't, you know, fall down a flight of stairs, you didn't, you weren't in a car accident, you have a fracture that just seems like, well, how could I possibly fracture? That's really odd. Yeah, get your bone density. Make sure you don't have thinning. Maybe you have a family history. Again, that's important. important to know. Not everyone does, but there's a lot of osteoporosis then. Check it out. If you're on those high-risk medicines that we talked about, especially things like prednisone or steroids or proton pump inhibitors, and you're on them for life, meaning that you can't go off of them medically, then you should probably get a baseline at some point. I think for those who do get a bone density test, a DEXA, at one point, it would be good to get a trabecular score. So you measure that once, so you just know what the quality of your bone is. You don't have to get that every time, but that's good to know. One way to kind of go about this is to get an annual exam. Not everyone feels like, you know, hey, I'm healthy, I'm fine, why do I need to go see my doctor? You know, but going in once a year affords the opportunity, and hint, hint, the time, because you have more time usually on a physical, it allows the opportunity to ask questions about this and to consider, maybe there are reasons you don't need a DEXA, maybe it's kind of a worthless test for you, but it allows time to ask about what are the options. And I think that's really important. There are these online tools. There's one called FRAX, F-R-A-X, Fracture Risk Assessment Tool, which is, it's online. I actually did it before I started this visit with you today, just because I wanted to see what it gave me, even though I already know my risks and so forth. And it's a tool that you can look at to kind of determine what your risks are. And it goes through, you know, your age, your sex, your weight, your height, if you've had a previous fracture, if you have a parent who's had a fractured hip, not spine, but hip, if you're a smoker, if you're on steroids, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, I do, if you have secondary osteoporosis, meaning caused by something else, if you drink more than 3 alcohol units per day, whatever that is, and then you write in your femoral neck bone density score. So it's assuming you've had a DEXA already. So maybe that's just something you have to remember, that's what the FRAX tool is for. And it gives you the 10-year probability of a fracture based on that information. And then if you happen to know your trabecular score, you can put that in and then it recalculates. So I did both and my score reduced by 2 points because of my nice trabecular score. So the bottom line is there are many tools that are available to look at your risk for fracture. And, you know, some of it's just kind of interesting data, but sometimes it can actually really lead to changes and be helpful.
Awesome. Really helpful. I'm going to put the link to the FRAX tool into the show notes. Susan, it's been such a pleasure and honor to have you share your knowledge about this. This is really great. And it's something that I want, want people to know more about. So for the listeners out there who are like, oh my gosh, Susan's amazing, I want to get in touch, want to hear a little bit more about her advocate program, what is the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so my website, mymdadvocate.com, is my business profile and my contact information is there. For visitors who are interested, I'm actually licensed to practice medicine in Washington State. So in terms of if you want to work with me and actually engage my help as a physician, you'd have to be in Washington State. But I have that free menopause menu website, which is helpful for a lot of people. And of course, my book, The Menopause Menu, which is available on Amazon and Apple Books and Barnes & Noble. But Amazon for the actual book and the other for an ebook. And then I do have a YouTube channel, which is more fun than anything, but I do have some professional videos there as well in terms of what I do. But I'm really delighted that we were able to talk about such a great topic.
It's awesome. And I'm excited for the world to listen to it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you got some help from today's podcast. And for more info, check us out at ifixyoursciatica.com. Have a fantastic and pain-free day. No patient-therapist relationship is formed by listening to this podcast. We are not providing medical advice, and all information should be confirmed by a medical provider.